You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, I feel like I need to get that. You remember that Will Smith song from probably 20 years ago, Summertime?
Yes.
I feel like I need to get some version of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We need to kind of sample that out.
Summertime.
It's very, yeah. How is it where you are in Colorado?
Hot.
Oh, like how hot, though?
It depends. Like, it depends on the hour of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is Colorado. We have four seasons of weather all in the same day, usually.
Yes. Yeah.
So it gets really hot and we'll hit 95 to 100 around noon. And then the thunderstorms roll in and we get hail.
Ooh.
And then the temperature drops to like 80, 75, somewhere in there.
And then it's
and
frogs.
Then slowly starts
it's raining
to climb
frogs.
Back up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
God.
I've had my air conditioner on quite a bit. I actually was able to take it and turn it off for like a week.
Yeah.
In the middle of June, which is really, really weird. So, yeah. But other than that, hi.
Hi. Yeah. It's been a minute. So we took a week off, which is like so luxurious for us for the 4th of July, bang, bang, splody week, as I call it around these parts. I don't know. I know that you were posting some of this on Facebook, but the neighborhood that I'm in, I'm right near a golf course. I'm not actually a golf course house. I don't make that kind of money. But right near a golf course that does the municipal fireworks for my town. And if you sit in the park that's right off of my backyard, you can basically see all of them without dealing with the crowds, which is cool. But the weird thing that I don't get is all of my neighbors, they drive over to Indiana and buy up all the illegal fireworks.
Yeah.
Legal in Indiana, I should say, but illegal in the Chicagoland area. They come back over here, and at the same time as the big-ass municipal fireworks display, they're putting off their sort of, like, piddly junk rate display that they paid $500 for. And I'm like, you're not gonna... And it's such... I feel bad for them. I feel honestly bad. Like, so this is... Ellen, our guest this week, by the way, is Ellen Datlow. So, Ellen, did you get splody time in the East Village now, or
Well, I'm in Stuyvesant Town, which is its own community, and I was able to watch the fireworks, the Macy's fireworks. There were three or five barges on the East River, and I could actually watch it from my bedroom window. So it was cool. I mean, I could only see one barge, but that was enough, you know.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful. I mean, it was really cool.
I have
and luckily it didn't rain then.
I have two bedroom windows. One faces east, one faces west. I could look out the east into the cul-de-sac where my neighbors were throwing this raging party and they were shooting off a billion fireworks. And if I looked out the west window, I could see the official fireworks going on way, way, way far away, but also the people down the road shooting off fireworks.
So if I
went out the front door, I could see fireworks going off in the neighborhoods around me. Like every block, people were just shooting off fireworks. Now, what's funny about that is, you know, those big signs, like the generator powered signs that they put on the side of the road that says, you know, lane closure up ahead.
Oh yeah, right. Kind of a neon, weird name.
Yeah,
neon.
They had those everywhere, all into all points of Aurora. They had those set up, basically saying, if it launches off the ground, it's illegal. You cannot shoot them off in Aurora. You will be prosecuted. Fines start at $2,500.
Wow.
Everybody was still shooting out fireworks like crazy.
Wow. Well, you know, they closed up. I mean, this is my first summer. I mean, I just moved to where I am now in December, and they closed off the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had to show ID to get in.
Yes.
I came home from shopping with a friend who lives here also, and they said, oh, we know, you know, like whatever. I mean, I showed my card. And I don't know. I didn't even think I showed the card, and they said, yeah. You know, we didn't look like the people who would be trespassing to get on for the fireworks. But the fireworks are from 23rd Street uptown.
Okay.
So, and my community starts, it's Peter Cooper Village in Stuyvesant Town. It's from 23rd Street to 14th.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm around 16th or so. So, yeah, they wouldn't allow, I guess in the past, people have overrun the area to see the fireworks and just, you know, run around. And they put a stop to that.
Interesting.
So I didn't go out at all. I just watched from my bedroom.
I sat in a chair with a trembling cat in my lap. He was yeah. not happy. He was very yeah. unhappy. You know, we talk about this quite a bit, Tracy, the fact that Zencastr gives us video now.
Yeah.
And we use the video so we could see each other and kind of not talk over each other. Something that John and I did many, many years ago with Google Hangouts. Like, we tried to do the same kind of setup.
Yeah.
What I like about this is that now we're getting glimpses into people's homes. And almost everybody that we talk to is either an author or an editor or something like that. They all have bookshelves.
Mm-hmm.
Filled yep. with books. Ellen is the first one that has a ladder.
I don't have a ladder. Wait.
Isn't that a ladder?
No, it's just my bookshelves.
Oh, that's just another bookshelf.
It's another bookshelf.
Yeah, no, I have bookshelves yeah. all along. No, I wish I had a ladder.
I thought that was a ladder.
I don't need a ladder, actually. I can use a step stool, but no, it's not a ladder.
Oh.
If I wish I had bookshelves that and ceilings that high, that I would need a ladder. But no, and I got rid of so many books before I moved.
Oh, I used to have them
all
so
over
hard.
The floor,
so
and hard. I refuse to do that anymore. No more books on the floor.
Okay, so I feel like that there
are bookshelves.
I feel like there is naturally an editor question that's sitting there and the idea of having to move house and having to weed through your books. Pause button for a moment. For those of you who don't know Ellen Datlow, one, where have you been? chances are extremely good that if you have read any anthology in the world of science fiction, fantasy, and horror that covers any particular kind of theme, any particular lean towards the surreal, the strange, the wondrous, and the horrifying, you have seen stuff that Ellen Datlow's hands have touched, so to speak. And so since you've spent so much of your career looking carefully at things and judging their merits and thinking about how they're good and how they could be better, how on earth do you weed your own book collection? Oh, my word.
Well, I have my own, but the big problem is my own books. Mm. Then they're in storage. I have a storage locker that costs me a lot of money with my own books in it. I still have a few other people's books, but I try to get rid of those. I've been trying to get rid of books for ages. Partly what happened is it was under control when I worked at Omni because I had an office that I had half my books there. Once we closed down the office, all those books had to come home with me or do go somewhere. And it's been hell ever since. But now I honestly hardly keep any novels. I mean, I get, okay, how many years have I been doing the Year's Best? Since I've been doing them 30 years now, approximately, mm-hmm. including the Year's Best Fantasy and Horror and Best Horror. Mm-hmm. So imagine how many books I get for that, okay? Imagine that I only keep 1% of those books. It doesn't matter. They still have piled up over the years. I do not keep novels mm-hmm. very often. I don't keep anthologies at all, other people's mm-hmm. anthologies, unless they're kind of classic or something, or even those I've been getting rid of. And I only really try to keep collections, single author collections.
Yeah.
It's brutal, but you got to do it. I mean, I also got rid of a couple of hundred CDs when I moved. And yeah. I still have 100 left
yeah. in my own yeah.
book. But, you know, these are the books that are left from after culling. And I still have to cull because, you know, there's more. I have a cocktail table, which mm-hmm. I used to work on all the time. Mm-hmm. Now it is filled, unfortunately, with books that have come in from the Year's Best. They're not supposed to be here. I have a little bookshelf in my foyer that is specifically for incoming stuff, reading from for the Year's Best. But unfortunately, that overflows. It's filled, and I have to figure out how to get rid of quickly get rid of the books next to me that I don't want to see.
See, this is a problem that I hear about quite a bit from different people. DiNardo and I, John DiNardo from SF Signal, mm-hmm. we used to talk about this all the time because he would get so many books sent for the website.
Right.
And his basement was basically a library. And he
well,
would get
I
to
wish
point,
I had a basement or an attic.
And then he would get to a point where his wife's like, okay, he's got to go. Mm-hmm. And he would start, you know, culling and basically taking books to the library. And it was physically painful for him to do so because he wanted to read the books, but he didn't have enough time to read all the books that people were sending him. So
yep.
then he's having to take them to the library and donate them. And then he found out that they don't keep them. They sell them and they buy what they want. And that hurt. And he kind of had to get over that as well.
Right.
You know?
Well, we have one of those little tiny libraries outside now.
Yeah.
You know, one
yeah.
of those little things.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm bringing things out there. And they disappear, and that's great. Even some foreign editions. I mean, I get foreign editions of my books. I really only need one or two copies. I do not need five or 10.
Yeah.
I actually got 28 copies of the Chinese edition of one of my anthologies by accident. They were supposed to send them to the authors, but they sent them to me. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do with 28 Chinese anthologies of my own, you know, copies? And I called around. I finally found a community center in Chinatown that took them. They were so happy.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I they wanted to pay for the postage. I said, no, I'll pay for the postage. And they want me to visit them. I was like, if I'm in the neighborhood, I will. Sure. You know, they want to put something saying donated by, which is really sweet.
Yeah, that's
but I'm just
nice.
Happy to get rid of them.
I can put
a couple of foreign ones in the library. The Russian ones disappeared. I think there are some Russian speaking people around the area.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's awesome. Here's another story for you, Tracy. So yeah. Karen Burnham, she was part of Locus for a very long time. She's part of SF.
Is she not working for Locus anymore?
I think she still does stuff for them. Yes, I think she does. I don't keep up with Locus, unfortunately, so I couldn't tell you for sure, but I think she does.
She's done reviews for them.
She's done things with ICFA in the past. She was a NASA engineer. Now she's moved into the private sector and she's done a lot of things. She was also a protege of Gardner Dozois.
And I didn't know that.
When he passed, she inherited his books.
She did?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He sent
yay,
all
and
those
also
books.
No.
Yeah. So she had to, her and Curtis had to figure out where to put all those books. And it's not just the books that he wrote or that he was part of as an editor. It was also all of his nonfiction. It was like everything. It was his library. That's what she inherited and had to find a spot to put those in and keep them. And she has them all cataloged too, you know, because Karen's Karen. So she actually cataloged them and put them in a database and now has it all in the computer.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised he didn't donate his whole library to one of the science fiction collections.
Me too. I don't know. I don't know what the thought was there, but I just remember the posts on Facebook, you know, of her talking about, oh my God, I've got all these books now. And then like posting that they were building new bookshelves for them and cataloging them and doing all this stuff. So, yeah.
So one of the reasons that you're on with us, Ellen, is that you've got a new anthology coming out from Tachyon in October. So we're ahead of the curve now, kind of getting things ramped up here for Body Shocks, which is Extreme Takes of Body Horror. And I have a colleague, I teach speculative fiction at the school where I work, among other things. It's not the only thing I teach. And one of my colleagues there who teaches the class with me from time to time is very into body horror. He's always sort of fascinated by it. And it's sort of funny because it's one of the places where he and I really differ a lot, that I have certain lines where I sort of hit that in something that I'm reading and I'm going like, nope, can't do it. And it made me wonder, is there an Ellen Datlow line of like,
The weird thing, okay, I mean, we put the title Extreme Horror in there because we needed a subtitle. I had to figure something out. I'm actually not into it, what I would consider extreme horror. I mean, there are writers who have no interest in reading, who I'm not saying they're terrible writers, although a few might be, but they are into things that really gross horror that I'm not into. So actually when doing Body Shocks, it was a challenge to find stories that I found that weren't about body horror. And maybe some people think they're extreme, but most of them I don't consider extreme. It depends on your definition of extreme.
Right. Yeah. Very relative kind of landscape there.
So, I mean, I would like to think that the stories I chose are a good mix. I don't know if either of you have looked if you've gotten a PDF file or anything.
I have not.
Yeah, well, they're all reprints, and they range from 1984. I just checked 2017. And some of the stories are things that I remembered reading that I really liked and that are definitely horrific. And I don't know how to define extreme. But there are stories in there that I don't want to read more than once, although I've read them a couple of times, you know, just.
Yeah, and the necessities of editing.
So, yes, I mean, there is a line, but it's, you know, it's like when I see it, I know it, you know, it's like kind of thing.
Yeah. Do you think the line has some, is the line about you as a reader, or is it sort of about like the composition of the anthology? Like this may be a good story, but this doesn't have a place in what I'm trying to.
Well, that's a whole different. That's a whole different question.
Yeah.
I mean, picking stories that fit a theme.
Yeah.
That's a whole different discussion, actually. When I was looking for the body horror things, I usually don't put out public calls for my anthologies, but my reprints anthology is the closest I do for that. And what I do is what I probably generally do is go to many of my writers who I think might have had something that would have been appropriate, and some who I doubt do, but might. And I say, you know, do you have anything? And here's my definition. Here's the definition. First, you have to define what do you consider body horror? Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it's mutilation. I mean, it's in my introduction. It's like the breaching the integrity of the body in some way, mentally, more physically. And so that I have to have that idea when I was looking for stories. Okay. So I go out and send a proposal, or not a proposal, but the idea of what I consider body horror to a whole bunch of writers who I've worked with. And some of them said, I don't have anything, I don't think. And some said, well, maybe I do. And some sent me things that were totally inappropriate because they weren't what I would consider body horror, you know. And then there are stories a few stories I took that were really, really disturbing. I mean, they are disturbing. That's the whole point. So it's, as with any theme, it's, does it go with what I consider body horror? And when I do theme anthologies, I try to be as broad as possible. Mm-hmm. I like to push the boundaries of what, If I can justify why I'm publishing a story in a particular anthology, then I can include it if I love the story.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of what is the story about, does it fit the theme, and if it's so disgusting, is that a bad thing or a good thing? It depends on how the story, you know, how well written it is, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, there were stories that I thought about that I really, really liked that I had published in the past or reprinted and Year's Best and things. And I didn't feel, I mean, I'm thinking of one particular story that was pretty horrific and pretty disturbing. But one of the reasons I ended up not taking it is because from the point of view of the person being abused, mm-hmm. breached and whatever, they didn't think it was horror. They were happy with what was going on. So I didn't feel I could and wanted to include that. It also had sexual political implications now that I don't, that when it was written and published originally, it might not be acceptable now.
Yeah, it hasn't really survived.
Yeah, so there are a whole bunch of things. That's a reason why I did not take that one story. Although I took it for the Year's Best years ago.
Yeah. See, it's fascinating to me the process that you go through to figure out what stories to put in an anthology. I've talked to other folks in the past, including Gardner, who would not come on the podcast because he said no one wanted to listen to his voice. And
well, can I do a shrug?
And Jonathan Strawn and different ones. And, you know, everybody seems to have a little bit of a different take on how they find the stories that they mm-hmm. want to have in their mm-hmm. anthologies. Mm-hmm. But I do also like the stories where someone says, yeah, there was this one story I really wanted, but damn it, Ellen got it first.
Well, if it's an original story, that's one thing. But if it's a reprint, you know, we can all reprint things in for our Year's Best. I don't mind if people have the same story that I'm reprinting. Although I do admit Paula Guerin and I, every once in a while, we will compare notes. If we both love two stories by a particular author that we want to take that year, we usually will come to an agreement. Okay, you take that one, I'll take this one. Only if we love both stories and want to take them, you know, so that we don't repeat.
I've always loved anthologies because it's like a mixtape.
Yeah. Sure.
And it just exposes you to so many different voices, mm-hmm. you know, in one package, really.
Well, that's really important. That's one part of the anthologist's job for original anthologies and reprint is that you want to get as many voices as you can. You don't want, just because something's on a theme, you don't have to have a sameness of story. And you shouldn't have a sameness, you know. That's the whole point. You have different voices, different tones, different venue, you know, different backgrounds, different kinds of characters. Even within a theme, there can be great variety. There should be great variety, or it's going to be a lousy anthology.
Yeah. When I was a teenager, I loved buying CDs that were compilations, anthologies in their own right. I loved getting movie soundtracks.
I used a lot of different
mm-hmm. Popular music, and because again, that gave you different voices. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize at the time that that was prepping me for loving anthologies.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know?
Yeah. No, I mean, I remember buying, I bought a couple of CDs that were compilations of, I don't even know what the theme was. It was new music. And I remember, Huey Lewis and the News was on there, so I don't remember what the theme was, but it was, it was that period of time. And it introduced me to a lot of new musicians and groups that I never had heard of. That's a good thing about anthologies of any kind. It hopefully introduced you to new voices.
Exactly. And the way I always saw the compilation CDs was, if I suddenly liked something, like I liked a certain kind of music, and I'm going to go to the blues, for example. When Eric Clapton went on MTV Live and he did a blues album, mm-hmm. that was my first experience with blues. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, I really like this. But I don't know who else to listen to. I don't know who else to get into. Mm-hmm. So I started looking for and buying. I would go to the music store, and I would go down the blues aisle to the various artists section, where it would mm-hmm. be various artists on these albums. And I would go through those and buy, the House of Blues, Best of Blues, Guitar Blues, Chicago Blues.
Right.
And I would get those, and it just helped me get exposed mm-hmm. to different people.
Yeah, well, I prefer the old blues is what I've mm-hmm. discovered. When I was in college, I heard the Paul Butterfield Band, and I hated them. I hated them. But on the other hand, I did like Clapton. I mean, there are other blues, contemporary that time blues people I did like, but that got me into looking at the old blues, which I prefer much better than to most of the current blues. when I was younger, now they're like old fashioned too. the old ones from the 40s, the original blues.
Yes, yes.
That is what I really like.
That's some of my favorite blues too. I love that. But I also, mm-hmm. I mean, I do like when someone like Joe Bonamassa comes along he just reinvigorates the blues, right? And he just brings it back and mm-hmm. Clapton did it. Mm-hmm. And Kenny Wayne Shepherd did it. And there's all these contemporaries and who in their time, Stevie Ray Vaughan mm-hmm. did it, right? They just mm-hmm. bring it and they elevate it back up and kind of bring it back into people's consciousness.
Right.
So I love the older stuff, but I also love it when someone new mm-hmm. says, oh my gosh, people do love the blues. I've always loved the blues. Let me do a blues album. The Tedeschi Trucks Band is another great example. I, mm-hmm. I love their take on kind of Southern rock and blues. Mm-hmm. While we were chatting, I pulled up Karen Burnham's posts about the bookshelves. She has over 30 bookshelves mm-hmm. in her house now. And the reason I wanted to mention this is because I got to a picture that's a bookshelf 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. And she says, I have a complete run of the Windling Datlow anthologies.
Oh, cool. Which one?
That's what I'm wondering. No picture.
Maybe,
she says she has
she probably, run. It sounds like, well, she may be talking about the year's best, which would be 16. And then the last five were with Gavin Grant and Kelly Link.
Okay.
And there could have been the fairy tale anthologies. I mean, we did we've done other anthologies together, the mythic series and the fairy tale. And we did three middle grade fairy tale books too. So, but I'm guessing she's talking about Year's Best Fantasy and Horror.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in also thinking of the mixtape and the aesthetic of combining things together and picking and choosing, but also how your aesthetic might, that there's certain editors who all want the same thing or get excited about similar things. Do you pick the people who you collaborate with as co-editors, or sometimes do they come on the project with you because of the publisher? How does that
oh, never, 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 never from the publisher. No.
Yeah.
I mean, the only time I've collaborated, and I honestly don't really like collaborating as much as not is going solo, partly because it's all my taste if I do it myself. It's with the collaborator, you by necessity may be compromising on a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
Terry and I started collaborating. Jim Frankel was the one who suggested we do it. He suggested we do the Year of Best Fantasy and Horror. He published it for many years at St. Martin's. And he's the one who suggested that we work together on that. Although with the Year's Best, we never worked together. She was in fantasy. I was totally in horror. Rarely did the twain meet, although occasionally we both liked the same story and we both wrote little intros to them. But that's how we started collaborating. And then that's when we started to do more collaborations. And working with Terry was a joy. You know, we usually have a rule, and what I've done with collaborators, you have one free story that you can say no to for no any reason. You have one free story that if you really like it and the other one doesn't hate it, you can take it. You know, so you have like a compromise there. And, you know, sometimes that with Terry, that happened once or twice. I mean, there was a story that really upset her, you know, because it covered ground she didn't feel comfortable with. And I took that for something else. I mean, it was okay. And that was an original anthology. But anyway, so yes, I mean, you have to get along with your co-editor. With Nick Mamatas and I worked on Haunted Legends, which was kind of a retelling of urban legends. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was originally going to be an HWA anthology. He pitched it to them as an HWA anthology, but they'd never, at that time, it was very disorganized and we didn't have like a publisher. We didn't get it together, or they didn't get it together. So he approached me and he said, well, do you want to do this with me? I said, maybe. Because I know Nick. Nick is very, one-on-one, he's a great guy. On the internet, he's kind of a monster. Or he has been. I haven't actually followed him in the last few years. But he used to be pretty monstrous, I have to say. And so I'm thinking, is this someone I can work with for like 2 years or whatever? So I called, we talked on the phone. And he was very deferential. And because of that, and I'm not saying as who would be the boss kind of thing, but that he wouldn't be a jackass in a way. I mean, I know. I mean, this is probably, I think Nick would laugh if he heard this, but I hope. But anyway, I talked to him and we discussed it. He also wanted an open market. So we actually had an open reading and he volunteered to read the slush for like a week or 2 weeks. And then he'd pass on 20 stories or whatever, 30 stories to me. So that worked out well. We worked well together. And Lisa Morton and I worked on the Haunted Nights, which was a Halloween anthology for HWA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I would never work, a publisher doesn't usually tell you who to collaborate with. I mean, yeah. At least I've never had the experience. Mm-hmm. Now, my agent, once in a while, she in the past would make suggestions. How about, you want to do an anthology on blah, blah. And I said, no, you know, I have no, sorry, I'm just not interested in it. You know, it's a good idea, but not for me, or I don't think it's going to sell. And once in a blue moon, she represents Octavia Butler and Octavia Butler's estate now. And at the time she was thinking that, you know, I should co-edit an anthology somehow related to Octavia. I can't remember how. And I said, no, I just feel no. I mean, I love Octavia. It's like not, I shouldn't be doing this and I wouldn't want to do this.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's not, you know, I'm not African American and I just didn't. And also I don't remember if there was a theme. I don't remember exactly the details, but I just didn't feel that I was the right person for it for many reasons.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, but that's the only time anyone, and I would have been editing it with somebody probably, mm-hmm. you know, but so, nah.
So I have a question, and this is very similar. So whenever I go to a convention, I almost always get put on the podcast panel. And on the podcast panel, you know, is all the wannabe podcasters in the audience going, you know, should I start a podcast? And what's involved with starting a podcast? And how do I do it? And, you know, and they're just so excited. And I don't want to crush their dreams and mm-hmm. tell them that it's going to be a pain in the ass. And there's a lot
sometimes
of work involved.
You should crush their dreams.
I have toyed with this idea for a while. So my mom died in March. She had mm-hmm. Alzheimer's, and I took care of her for 10 years. And I have toyed with the idea, we've even talked about it on the podcast, of doing like an anthology for charity under the Functional Nerds brand, you know, and donating the money to Alzheimer's research kind of thing. You know, if you're sitting on the panel at the convention and I'm in the audience and I'm like super excited and I'm thinking about doing this anthology thing, like what's the advice that you give that person?
Don't do it. No, okay. Seriously, I think charity anthologies are done by good-hearted people. It's best to give the money directly to the charity. You're gonna, even if you raise any money past what you are, your production costs, you're not going to make enough money. It's going to be 2 years down the line or 3 years down the line. It's not worth it for the, I mean, if that's what your actual aim is. If you are thinking to publicize that charity, it depends on who's in the book and who's editing it and who's publishing it. Because if it's self-published, no one's going to know it exists anyway. So it's not going to, no, seriously. I mean,
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, this is serious stuff. And I mean, that's the only reason, that's why I'm against charity anthologies. That's the only reason I'm against them, because I don't think they're useful for the charity. And if that's what you really want to do, just get people to donate directly to the charity.
Yep, that makes total sense.
So, and that's, if anyone ever asks me, that's what I say.
Yeah, when people, I mean, they always want to know, how do you monetize a podcast? I'm like, be famous before you start it.
Yeah. Probably. And self-published books. Yes, people self-publish all the time and some are very successful. Most of them, I'd say 99.9, are people who have a reputation before they start.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like this tiny, tiny percentage of somehow make their self-published book a bestseller. I mean, it's so rare. And they spend probably, the people who I've known about who've done it, I remember one person, I don't remember the name of the person, who went city by city selling books, her books out of her back of the truck. And then eventually, I think, went to a traditional publisher. Because you're spending all your time selling your books.
Yeah.
Do you want to write books or do you want to be there out there and selling them yourself, hand selling them? What is your ambition? You know?
And what's your goal? What's your goal? What's your expectation? Well,
that's what I mean. That's what I mean as far as ambition. What do you want out of publishing? Do you want to write more books, or you have one book you want to write and you want to sell it? Then that's fine. So self-publish it. And, you know, as I said, I was at a workshop several years ago, and one person there said he self-published and he was doing really well. And we looked at his Amazon numbers. He was. None of us had any idea why or how. But he was making enough money that it was worth his while to do it.
Sure.
But that is so rare.
It's almost as rare as the successful author inside the publishing industry, inside the traditional publishing
industry.
It's
way more rare than that.
Because, I mean, you have tons of people, and when we've talked about this before, you know, again, it's setting the expectation of what is success. Right. What is success for you as an
individual? Who do you want to, who is your audience? Who do you want to read your book?
Yeah.
Do you want to reach a lot of people to read your book, or do you want like 100 people to read it? Is 100 people enough for you?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Or do you want a wide audience to read what you're writing?
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm wondering, because I know you've also edited some longer things, things that aren't short stories and anthologies and magazines and so on. How do you find yourself getting into, you know, people's novellas or longer projects or things like that?
Well, mostly, I mean, I've done novellas. I have actually in the past consulted for Tor as a book editor 15 years ago or so.
Yeah.
I mean, I edited 3 of Jonathan Carroll's novels and about 3 of Paul Macaulay's novels, but I don't feel proficient in it. A novel is so much more, it's got so much more, it's so much more complex than a short story, novelette, or even novella. And I don't feel comfortable doing novels. Now, if I worked a lot in novels, I probably would pick it up, but it's not something I enjoy. Novellas, I didn't start editing really. I mean, every once in a while, John Langan, God help me, would write a novella for one of my anthologies. So I'd be editing a novella. But I started working on the novella when I started acquiring Fatour.com as a consulting editor. I was able to buy whatever I wanted for the website. And initially we were putting novellas on the website. Mm-hmm. And so I had actually edited two or three novellas for the website. And then after that, we did them as books. And we've been doing that ever since. And it's a little more, I mean, it's more work because it's longer. The longer a piece of fiction is, the more there is to work with and to figure out if something's working or not. I'm not great on structural problems. That, I think the longer a piece of fiction is, the more structural issues you might have with it.
Yeah.
And so I'm not an expert in that. I forget what the question was. I mean, I mean, I love novellas now, but they are more complicated than editing short stories and novelettes.
Is it
a structural thing, or is it like a word count that there's your limit? Do you have an upper limit?
Oh, for what a novella is, or what a word
for, with? For like, if someone sends you something and says, "Here's my story. It's this many words." You're like, "No, that's too many. I don't go that high."
Well, if it's over novella, I don't acquire novels for tour.com. Although, there's a very narrow line, a thin line between novellas and short novels.
Yeah.
So depend if it's like close, I would do it. I would work if I could work on it.
Yeah.
What did kind of aggravate me, I actually was a judge for supposedly for a novella contest. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give details because it eventually fell through, but and we were going to be given novellas to read and to judge. I was a judge for this contest, and it was the first time it was being done. It was another country, but they were in English. And then I got these. And to me, a novella is up to 39,999 words. Above that, it is a novel. All right. These were all 60,000 words. It's like, I'm sorry, that is not my definition of a novella. It's like, so, and we were stuck because we had committed to it. And it's like, never again. Next time I would say, this is what a novella is. It is not 60,000 words.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, because there is a difference between 30,000 and 40,000. That 20,000 word difference does make a big difference.
Yeah, I was going to say because
it's a novel.
I have some novels over here from the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Sure, and they were
60,
very
000.
Short.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, if it's on the line, I mean, I have acquired some novellas that I can't believe they're novellas because I read so fast. Because they're so quick moving. It's like, that's a novella? It feels really short, which is good. I mean, that's very good.
Yeah.
But it was kind of surprising. But it's a complexity. I mean, the longer something is, the more threads you're going to have in the story and more going on and more backstory. And there's more possibility for going wrong.
Yeah.
Getting something that's a little off.
I guess the last thing that I'm really curious about, and I think this a lot when I think I wonder about this a lot is what I should say, when I have the chance to talk to someone who has a really established career and has had a lot of opportunities to work with really interesting and diverse groups of people and so on, I get interested in like, where does that professional come from? Like if we were to go back in the DeLorean or the time machine of your choice, mm-hmm. and go and see like little Ellen Datlow or whatever, like what's the book or the movie or the comic or the whatever or group of them that kind of like set you on the course to get into what you do now?
Well, the Mushroom Planet books by Eleanor Cameron, which probably you don't even know.
I don't.
I think they were, I'm not sure when they were actually published, but I read them in the 50s. They were probably published before that. Mr. Bass's Planetoid, The Wonderful Trip to the Mushroom Planet, it's a whole series. That was when I was really, really young. Those are the youngest things. That's the earliest that I can remember that I read of that. But I also read, I've said this in interviews, I've read everything in my parents' house that I could. They had Bullfinch's Mythology. I read that.
I love that one.
You know, and Iliad and the Odyssey. That was later, but I liked the Odyssey, but I hated the Iliad. The Odyssey was an adventure. The Iliad was fucking boring, excuse me. At least at the time. I haven't read it since. But, I was into, and I was just a reader. I mean, I was one of those kids who I was reading in my room until my parents said, you have to stop. we have to, we're eating dinner, come mm-hmm. into dinner. I was like, no, no, just one more chapter. So, you know, I was one of those kids who, in red cereal boxes.
See, I always felt that I was lucky because, well, I didn't get to read what my mom had in the house because she had romance novels, mm-hmm. Harlequin, right? But she always made a point of taking me and letting me get stuff. Right,
the library of books. I went to the library all the time.
We would do that whenever the little Scholastic thing would come to school.
Oh, the bookmobile. Remember the book? Did they have bookmobiles when you were a kid?
Yeah, I think so. And there was just tons of things in there, and you could order. And I would mark everything I wanted, and then she would cull it down to what she could afford, and I would mm-hmm. get a couple of books that way. Mm-hmm. And then I remember discovering the bookstore in the mall. Mm-hmm. And I would save up money to buy books that way. And then I've told this story before. She told, because she was a bartender, she told her customers that her son loved to read and that he was into Star Trek. And suddenly this guy started bringing in boxes of old Star Trek novels, pocket novels uh-huh. that he had read and was done with. And mm-hmm. so then I got all those. That's what I'm pointing to over here. They're on this mm-hmm. shelf, to, you know, mm-hmm. to my left.
Yeah.
So it's awesome when you do have parents who encourage the reading.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a shame when they don't. Yeah. My father read a lot of Gothic romances because he was into history. Mm. My father loved history, and he read all these in the store. Well, he owned a luncheonette when I was growing up, so that was also, and I read comic books all the time, but I had to read them in the store and not take them home.
Sure.
But my dad had, he had all these Lancer Men's Adventure books, you know, which were from also, I guess, the 60s, early 60s. And they were, well, anyway, he got, what he would do, we'd go to a bookstore, I'd look at whatever I was looking at, or even a drugstore, and he'd go through the, you know, the, what are they, those, what are they called? The carousels.
Yeah, the
carousels of books. And he would just skim all these historical romances. And I think it was mostly because of the history. And he would just read them in the store, which is like, I'm sure, you know, the storekeepers must have hated that. But he owned a luncheonette. He would know that, you know, did you really care for your customers to be reading in the store? You know, but anyway, that's when I was growing up, after he had the store, he was reading them in bookstores or in drugstores, you know, while he was standing there. And he always had a ton of them on his night table. Yeah. So, yeah, my parent, I'm trying to remember if my mom read that much. She must have. I mean, she went back to school and became an elementary school teacher. I don't remember what she read when I was a kid, but I just remember my dad was reading all this stuff and Playboys. I would sneak in. when my parents weren't home, I would look in their drawers all the time. Yeah, and yeah. I got a very peculiar idea of sex from my dad's books.
My grandmother had Reader's Digest.
Oh, that we didn't have, but I read it in I went to music school, and in the waiting room, I read all the Reader's Digest there.
Yeah, yeah.
What crap. Not the condensed books, the actual Reader's Digest. Like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of funny the way everybody who continues to value books in the rest of their life has some kind of pedigree that traces back to their childhood and mm-hmm. either like never having access but always longing for it, or having constant access and like sort of that developing the hunger in a different way. Mm-hmm. My dad was never much of a reader. I honestly don't remember more than two or three occasions ever seeing a book in his hands. But my mom was a constant reader. And her whole way of functioning was she loved the used bookstores that were in my area, and also like the Friendton Library book sale that would happen once in the spring and once in the fall. And she would always like to take us to the Friends of the Library book sale on the last day, which was here's a paper bag. Anything that you can fit in here, the whole bag is $2. And right. she would just like give my brother a paper bag, give me a paper bag, and she would take a paper bag. And we'd come home with just $6 turning into, you know, 100 books between the lot of us. But one of the coolest things about her as a parent was that she never said no to anything where books were concerned. If she saw something that she had even the faintest notion that I might be interested in it, she would grab it. She'd be like, well, it's 25 cents here. I'm going to do it and see if Tracy wants it. And so I always had this abundance of options surrounding me of just like stuff that mama, she would be like this lioness dragging home a book kill and like, you know, just tossing the carcass in front of me, be like, look, I found this stuff. It has spaceships on the cover. I figured you'd like it. Or like, look, there are elves with swords. Figured you'd like it. Right. And it was because she had no discrimination of her own about genre literature or opinions of her own about genre literature, everything was fair game. And so she would end up buying me books in a series that I would start reading, and I didn't realize I had started on book four. And I had this sort of very weird relationship to Terry Brooks because of it, because like she got me the Sword of Shannara series, but in bits and pieces out of order with like four or five copies of the same book over and over again. But it was just, it was this constant reminder of her fundamental enthusiasm for the fact that I wanted to put my nose in a book. And that was always really cool.
Yeah. I had one aunt who gave me books every year for my birthday. It was some kind of series. I remember they were hardcover with no covers on them. And I don't know who published them, but it was obviously a series because they all looked alike. And some things that I really found boring, though. Some of the Captain's Courageous. Who is that by? Does anyone?
Gosh, no, I don't know.
But anyway, I hated that. I mean, there were certain books I really didn't like. I just had no interest in them.
Yeah.
And then there were others that I don't even know how I picked them up.
Yeah, they just land in your life.
Yes.
So I'm looking at the time here, and we've been off on such a tear that I don't know that we've got time for picks of the week.
I don't think we do. No, we don't. But that's fine. I mean, Ellen, if you wanted to give us a pick, you could.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all right. Well, I just highly recommend. I was just at the Little Island, which is a new park right off the Hudson River built by Barry Diller, God help us, that is amazing. It's like this origami park that is, it can't be that large, but inside every bit of it is filled with flowers and planting. And they had a jazz band. They have a small but large amphitheater for events. They have a little tiny space for readings. They had bathrooms galore. I mean, I was there on Monday. It was like, you know, July 4th weekend. It was Monday. A lot of it was crowded. You have to, it's free, but you have to go in staggered every, you have to get a ticket. And it was, so it was crowded, but there was no problem with the bathrooms. High tech bathroom with things I never saw before, that you dry your hand by putting your hand in the two faucets and air comes out. That was really cool. And also there was there were like three food trucks and they were not crowded. And there was a jazz band and you could see, it was amazing. I highly recommend anyone visiting New York or living in New York to go to a Little Island. It just opened about a month ago.
That's awesome.
It's really spectacular.
Yeah.
It's fun.
That's awesome.
So that was my find recently.
It's good. That's, I mean, we need ways of expanding our worlds back to a comfortable and safe normal.
Yes. Oh, and so, I just want to mention, not only Body Shocks, I have three books coming out this year.
My gosh, let's hear about them.
Well, When Things Get Dark, which is stories influenced by Shirley Jackson, all new stories. Cool. And that's coming out from Titan, UK and US in September. And The Best Horror of the Year, number 13, will be out in November.
Fantastic.
Nightshade. So yeah, include and then Body Shocks too. So I'm really happy about that.
That's really great. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Ellen.
It was
super cool to talk to you. So if people want to follow up with you and see all of the projects you are constantly hamster wheeling your way through, where should they find you on?
They can find me on Facebook and Twitter. Yeah. I mean, if I remember, I post things on my blog and my website, but but mostly Facebook and Twitter.
All right, folks. So thanks so much for being with us, Ellen.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Wait. Don't hit stop or next or whatever you were about to do. Unless you're listening in the car and you were about to stop at that red light, go ahead and do that. But when you get going again, don't pass that red Taurus with the bumper stickers. I just don't trust them. Now that this episode of the Functional Nerds is over, you might be wondering to yourself, self, what's next? Well, if you're looking for another podcast to listen to, we recommend Beyond the Trope. Giles and Michelle have been putting out episodes regularly for over 7 years. They have a lot of great guests, just like we do, and you can check them out over at beyondthetrope.com. They also have a Patreon with a bunch of extra content for backers, which is cool. Speaking of, we have a Patreon where we offer cool extras. You can check it out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. And hey, I'm serious. Don't pass that Taurus.